Tonight, the 9 o'clock hour, we are celebrating the life and legacy of Mayor Harold Washington, the 30th anniversary of his death. It's coming up this weekend, November 25th, 1987. The first and only African-American mayor for the city of Chicago was elected in 1983, and shortly after winning his second term in 1987, died from a heart attack. Harold Washington is being remembered this week through all sorts of media and events, but Doug Seibold and Agate Publishing have decided the best way to honor the legacy of Harold Washington is to reissue Harold, the People's Mayor, an authorized biography of Mayor Harold Washington. The book was originally released in 1988 by longtime friend and civil rights activist Dempsey Travis. Travis himself died in 2009. The biography is considered one of the best books written on the life and politics of Harold Washington. It was written with cooperation and, of course, features the details that only a real-life friendship could provide. Tonight in studio with me, Doug Seibold, the founder of Agate Publishing. Thanks for being here, Doug. Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Justin.
Nice to meet you. Why reissue this book? I mean, because this wasn't an Agate Publishing property. So talk about what you knew about this book and why you want to reissue it.
Well, sure. We were familiar with Dempsey Travis's work. Just a remarkable figure, you know, somebody who is sort of had almost like a Zelig-like sort of place in Chicago politics and Chicago history throughout the 20th century. And among the many, many other things that he did, I mean, he was a jazz band leader.
Yeah.
He was a very prominent civil rights activist and the head of the Chicago NAACP and responsible for bringing Martin Luther King to Chicago in 1960 for that first march. A big figure in real estate in Chicago, and especially in the South Side, where he's based in Chatham. But he was also a writer and a publisher. He started his own little publishing venture called Urban Research Press, and they published, I think, well over a dozen books,
many
of which he wrote himself. And after Mr. Travis passed away in 2009, we were approached by his estate. Agate has a particular specialty in publishing books by African-American writers. And, of course, Chicago is sort of a longtime center in the United States of African-American publishing. An agent representing the estate approached me and said, "Are you interested in reissuing some of Dempsey Travis's work?" We did the first of those books that we've been bringing back into print about 2 years ago. His major work, The Autobiography of Black Chicago.
Yeah.
And as we were seeing the anniversary of Washington's death approach, I really felt like this was a great opportunity to bring this book back because it is just an incredibly dynamic and vibrant piece of Chicago history.
It really is. And reading it, as I was reading it today and over the weekend, it's amazing how intimate it is. You know, Dempsey Travis, a great writer, and I've had the privilege of meeting Mr. Travis at one point in my life, and understanding what he's done and in his own history, but also in his writings. When you start to read the story of Harold Washington, you're reading it from his best friend's point of view. And there's something tremendously intimate and almost just special about it in the way that you read, as someone who has to read a lot of biographies.
Yeah.
It's something I've never really, it's even hard to describe.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. I mean, this isn't Robert Caro on Lyndon Johnson.
Right.
You know, this is a very personal testament to the relationship between these two men, and in particular, it's a testament to the historic role that Washington played in Chicago and national politics. Dempsey Travis met Washington when they were teenagers, and they were students at what was then the very new DuSable High School, and they both grew up in Bronzeville, which was at that time one of the only places in Chicago, if not the only place, where black people were allowed to live. And the incredible concentration of sort of energy and talent that came out of that community is just mind-boggling now, even to think about, you know, 80 years later. I mean, you had people like John Johnson, you know, who was the creator of Johnson Publishing, Ebony and Jet magazine. Gus Savage, who went on to become a major political figure in Chicago. From entertainment, you had Nat King Cole, you know, the great, you know, singer and jazz pianist. Red Fox, you know, the star of Sanford and Son. And Harold Washington, all of these people, year, 2 years, 3 years apart at DuSable High School. And then Travis takes you every step of the way, you know, through the rest of Washington's youth and his career from that point forward, from the point of view of somebody who knows him intimately.
When you, I mean, you didn't grow up here. You grew up in New York City.
I did.
And to be a part of this project and to be a part of Agate and a place that, that celebrates black writers in Chicago, but particularly about this story. What did you know about it? I mean, because you came here right around like the heyday of Harold Washington.
Yes.
But what did you know as someone who didn't necessarily grow up here knowing Chicago? What are your thoughts or memories from that time?
You know, I came to Chicago in January of 86. And at that time...
Which is a great time to come to Chicago.
Yeah.
the Chicago Bears, but go ahead.
It was at that time, what was going on in Chicago politics, I think, was sort of captivating the entire country, as it had pretty much for the previous 3 years since the beginning of Washington's ultimately victorious campaign to be elected mayor in 1983. I think, you know, there are a couple of great histories of what happened then. Gary Rivlin's, you know, The Fire on the Prairie is a great one. But it was national news about the division among the political establishment in Chicago between, you know, sort of traditional machine aldermen who were looking to sort of maintain their prerogatives and the structures that had been so familiar in Chicago politics for decades before, and an insurgent group led by Washington, a coalition that was made up mainly of African Americans, a rising Latino faction.
Who wanted to change the entire political system.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the goal of Harold Washington, to say the machine, the way it's done now, public service to I forgot how he said it, but this idea that to preserve self-interest has got to go. We have to change the system. And that was what he was running up against, is a lot of aldermen who at the time, they all sort of came from the Chicago machine.
Sure. And as did Washington himself, which I think is something that you can't really underestimate. Washington was not an outsider. He was a lifelong insider who broke out. And I think that had everything to do with the nature of the movement that he ultimately ended up at the head of and with the success that they were having. These were people who understood deeply how the machine worked and how it had maintained its power for all of these decades.
Right.
And they had a deep understanding of the levers that needed to be pulled, specifically in the ballot box, in order to change, you know, create real change in Chicago. And it was, this was a process that unfolded over almost the entirety of Washington's first term. It wasn't enough that he won the election.
Right.
The entire city council was locked in conflict in a way that at this remove of more than 30 years, it's impossible for us remember just how divided the city was and how divided
and the
government
book,
was.
And the book, Dempsey Travis's book, gets into that. And
yes.
And it gets in, it's fascinating, and it's a page-turner towards the second half when you talk about what was happening behind the scenes as, you know, just political tensions were flaring up.
Right.
I mean, just chaos. In the way that you couldn't get anything through council because of the 29, the Verdoli Act 29. Everything that Washington wanted to do was met with resistance at every turn. And to read Dempsey Travis and talk about guys like Gus Savage and other people behind the calling it out. I mean, there's a great passage where they're calling it out that this is racist. That this is and Verdoli Act coming back saying, I want to put a I forgot the name of the in the book he mentioned it, the name of the ethical watchdog group, Conduct. I think it's called Conduct.
Sure.
That just seems to be really busy at this time because everyone is formally filing complaints about Conduct. And it's just a time in place and space that seems like it's, I don't know, from the 40s. And it's the 80s. It's the mid-80s.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that the racial conflict was sort of clear and present. And it had been, you know, the 1983 election, you know, that Washington ultimately won. Many people thought that just going through the primary was going to be sufficient because, you know, Chicago was essentially, you know, sort of a one-party town.
Right.
He wins the primary over eventual mayor Richard M. Daley and the incumbent Jane Byrne. But a lot of the white power structure in the city then threw its efforts behind a Republican candidate who ran a campaign that in retrospect now is so sort of conspicuously racially coded, it's hard to conceive of, you know, sort of from this
point.
Well,
it was before It's Too Late was one of the things.
Yes.
It was, and there's
they
another
used Bye Bye Blackbird as their campaign theme song. Yeah.
There's a great This American Life episode where Ira Glass, early in his career, within the first 50 episodes he ever did, he did a one-hour documentary about all of the racial overtones and not subtle in any way, yeah, like you just mentioned, that were in this race, and then and juxtaposed to what we know, this is not American history. This is not Jim Crow South. This is Chicago in 1983. You feel it with Dempsey Travis that there is this contrast of breaking through, that to have an African American to be the first mayor to break through the machine to say we're going to represent people, and the contrast that it's met with the ugliness of society and frankly this ugliness that didn't need to be hidden.
Right.
And there, that's a big part of what Dempsey Travis is talking about, the later part of Harold Washington's life.
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of the things that's important to remember about these guys and about their generation is this is the culmination of what had been essentially a 30-year battle in the part of their own lives and their own careers. You know, Harold Washington and Dempsey Travis end up graduating from what's then the still very new Roosevelt University, which is, you know, one of the things that they're doing is admitting more people, you know, more students, black students, Jewish students who've been denied opportunities in other schools. Washington goes on to Northwestern University Law School a few years later, only white student in his class. And, you know,
black student, yeah.
Only black student in his class.
Right.
And you know, year after year, stage after stage in their career, it's this effort to sort of break out of the constraints that, you know, African-American people had been facing, you know, in Chicago throughout the 20th century and just go from one step to another, trying to create more opportunity, trying to integrate, you know, different institutions and sort of chip away at this structure that, you know, they were used to this fight. You know, this was something that was not a shock, not a surprise. This was sort of the air they breathed and, you know, the ground they walked on, you know, through their entire lives.
Yeah, there's a thought, and Dempsey Travis mentions this idea that it is a continuation of the civil rights movement.
That's right.
To have Harold Washington be the mayor of Chicago, a traditionally segregated city with a Chicago machine that I was watching some clips today of him boasting about breaking the barrier, meaning more women in leadership positions, more people of color. At that, you know, the Mayor Richard J. Daley, it was just white dudes.
Right.
You know, besides Mayor Byrne, even when Mayor Byrne came in, it was just white dudes. There really was this idea that he was doing more for not just African Americans, but for gender, for Latino, and it's a coalition. And continue to talk about it, but it was almost the final for Chicago, the final step for a civil rights movement that started decades before.
Yeah, and I think you can't underestimate the impact of this idea of this coalition. When I came to Chicago as a young man, I've been sort of observing this from a distance, and then I move here and sort of. It is all-consuming at this time, the Council War situation and the gradual process by which Washington and his coalition are eventually gaining the power and influence that they need by winning one aldermanic seat after another so that they can eventually take control of the city council and grab the reins of the city government. It was exciting because it wasn't just about seeing this movement among African-American people, but to see sort of this traditional kind of repressive structure sort of be overcome. And there is this idea, as you said, that it's not just for black Chicagoans, but for Latino Chicagoans, for women, you know, for a whole range of sort of progressive aims that, you know, all of these folks are hoping to see happen in this city. And, you know, by now, people's conception of the bad old days of the machine have been pretty well entrenched by the work of people like Mike Royko, mm-hmm, and other journalists who've covered, you know, the machine and, you know, sort of really documented its excesses and its oppressive character, you know, very, very thoroughly.
What's great about the book, too, and I was sharing with Pete, our producer, just, you know, how many names are thrown in that Dempsey Travis is talking about, not knowing that they were going to be players or running the CTA or mayors later in life, or, you know, like so many politicians and names that were familiar in Chicago were involved and embroiled in the story of Harold Washington.
Yeah.
The story ends, of course, with the death of Harold Washington. And what we learn from Dempsey Travis and in the book is that we learn a lot of personal details about Harold. He's an avid reader. He has strange sleep patterns where sometimes he doesn't sleep at all. Obviously, we know about his language, a great orator. And he also talks at the end about recognizing that his friend was dying.
Yeah.
That's the part that I get really intimate with, because you start to recognize that people around him saw that something was wrong.
Yeah. And I think that that is part of the tragedy, I think, sometimes of some of these sort of transcendent leaders who end up at the head of movements, is they are doing so much for so many people and they are giving so much of themselves that even as we watch those sacrifices happening, it can be very hard for anybody to say, hey, you need to think about yourself. You need to do what you need to do, because everybody is so invested in seeing this person, you know, sort of lead the movement that they've been leading, you know, to reach the objectives that they've been trying to reach. And of course, nobody's more invested in than the person who's at the head, you know, themselves.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody could have gone to Mayor Washington at that time, especially after the triumphs that they'd achieved, you know, with these sort of electoral victories in 86 and 87, and said, okay, now it's time for you to, you know, take your foot off the pedal and, you know, sort of treat yourself a little bit better. You know, basically, and I think that's one of the things that's so tragic about his story, is that, you know, after finally winning all of these battles, you know, that had been fought tooth and nail over these preceding 4 years, when, you know, the promise really seems about to be fulfilled, is exactly when he passes away so shockingly and so suddenly.
The reissue is Harold, the People's Mayor, an authorized biography of Mayor Harold Washington. It's written by Dempsey Travis, a longtime civil rights activist who died in 2009. It's being released by Agate Publishing, and Doug Seibold, who's my guest tonight. It's available December 1st. Great read. It's something I have to say, I'm a big fan of Chicago history and politics, and I had not read this book. It's a great read. It's a must read if you're interested in Harold Washington and Dempsey Travis and their relationship. Doug, thanks so much for coming in and talking about it. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're continuing to look back at the life and legacy of former Chicago Mayor Harold Washington. The anniversary of his death is coming up this Saturday, November 25th, the 30-year anniversary. In studio tonight, a man who covered Harold Washington as a City Hall reporter from 1976 to 1992 for both the Daily Southtown and the Chicago Sun-Times, Ray Hanania, was able to have a front-row seat to the Washington election and administration, which included a groundswell mayoral campaign and a tenuous relationship with city council, prompting council wars, which pitted Washington and his allies versus 29 white aldermen led by Ed Verdoliak. Ray was there. Hanania is a reporter and author of several books, including I'm Glad I Look Like a Terrorist, Growing Up Arab in America, and he joins me tonight. Ray, good to see you.
Good to see you. I got a new book coming out called, it's not out yet, but it's called Good Story. That was the line that Harry Golden Jr. used to say every time he'd hear a great story. He goes, good story. His Brooklyn accent. So.
There you go. You know, as talked to Doug Seibold about Dempsey Travis's book, and a lot of that was interesting, because as I read through it, there were so many names that became more known in the 90s and 2000s through Daley's administration or continue to work in Chicago today. You know, thinking about that time, we all remember it as being a progressive time with a bunch of new people and trying to change. But how much was it? I mean, a lot of the same people in Chicago politics today were there in the 80s.
I tell you what, it was a war zone when Washington got elected. It was great when Jane Byrne was in, because she turned everything upside down. And I remember the first time I got to City Hall, I had covered Richard J. Daley briefly, but I met Mike Blandick. And Mike Blandick's biggest story the big exclusive in the Chicago Tribune was Mike Bolandic to run in the 10K marathon in Beverly Hills. That was a two-deck headline on the front page of, above the fold in the Tribune. That was the news. And then Jane Byrne comes in there, and we had to bring computers, tape recorders, print new editions, because the story would change. From 8 o'clock in the morning, we'd get there. By 11, she changed her story. By 1 o'clock, it was something else. And you had to cover her 24/7. And then Harold Washington came in, and the tone changed because of race.
When did you recognize that Harold Washington was a formidable challenge to Jane Byrne or Richard M. Daley at that time?
Honestly,
1983.
Nobody expected him to win. None of the traditional white media that was at City Hall. And all the reporters were white. And we all, honestly, we thought either Byrne was going to win or Daley was going to pull it off, because they were kind of rooting for Daley because he was the underdog. He was a nice guy, kind of goofy. You know, he wasn't like a slick politician. You know, a lot of people ask me, they go, why did Arabs come to Chicago? And when Daley was around, I said, that's because Chicago and the Middle East have the same thing in common. We both had dictators who could barely speak English. It was a great place to be. So
there's those stand-up comedy roots coming out. But I mean, there is... I mean, obviously, when I mentioned Groundswell mayoral campaign, there was a point where Chicago, the African-American community, the media, people started to recognize quickly before the Democratic primary that Harold Washington was a force to be reckoned with.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. The very first interview I did with Harold Washington was on a small public radio station. And the reporter and I and Harold sat there. And he was, and this was maybe about 6 months before he actually got in. He goes, I don't know if I'm going to run. He did it once before. You need a lot of money. You're up against the machine. Jane Byrne and Verdoliak and Burke and Fred Rohde and the First Ward Mob and Charlie Swibel. They ran everything in the city. So how do you break that? It was like impossible. And it is true that all of a sudden I think people – especially African Americans, 40% of the population, big voters. They always voted the way the machine asked them to vote. Every white candidate that they shoved down their throat, black voters would vote for them without it, because they were loyal and they believed in, they got services, or at least they thought they did. I don't think they got what they deserved. But when Harold ran, I think they realized, you know, why are we voting for Jane Byrne, who really upset us by appointing two women who were anti-black to the Board of Education and the Housing Authority, and they weren't getting services. It was the same thing, you know, when they were with Bolandic. Bolandic had all the services take the suburbanites, because they were the big workers for the big corporations in Chicago. He had to make sure that CTA went straight through the south side in the inner city and go right out to the suburbs. Forget about them. So the black community really kind of woke up, and they said, we're just not going to let this happen. And they came out. Now, I think he only got about 36% of the vote. He got a third of the vote, but just enough to beat Byrne, and Daley came in third.
Now, you would think in the city of Chicago, and this is where this story, and a lot of people know this story, but you would think that if you win the Democratic primary, you're a shoo-in.
Right.
The Democratic machine and
right.
the Cook County Democrats it get behind you and say, all right, this is our candidate.
But like they did with Jane Byrne.
Right.
She beat Bolandic, and they all finally came up. I remember Quigley came and kissed her. He had said so many bad things about her, but at a Democratic slate.
That's how it's supposed to be, right? I mean,
exactly.
That's how it's drawn
but
up.
Not with Washington.
But with Washington, it went in a different way, where a lot of establishment Chicago machine Democrats, white Democrats, They supported a Republican.
Yes,
and,
they did.
And
Bernie Epton, before it's too late. That was his campaign. Can you imagine somebody saying, you better vote for Bernie before it's too late? You know, what does that tell you? But a lot of people say, well, these guys were racist. But I'm going to tell you what. I don't think all the politicians were racist. I think they saw race as a way to win. It was like, how are we going to get white voters scared enough to come together, Daley and Byrne, and beat, you know, Washington? We got to get all those voters back together. And Daley was smart. He stood up and he said, you know what, Washington won, I'm going to support him. And everybody was mad at Daley because of that, a lot of white voters. But the politicians used race to scare, you know, whites into, you put him in there, it's over. Chicago will be gone. All the firemen and the policemen living in the corners, you know, huddled, they're like squeezed into the southwest and northwest side of Chicago. Their neighborhoods would be gone. Everything.
That was the, I mean, was the tactics they were using.
It was terrible.
The marketing.
Obviously, and then that went on for 4 years.
Well, that's what I want to get to. Ray Hanania is my guest in studio, longtime Chicago City Hall reporter, 1976 and 1992 for the South Town and the Chicago Sun-Times. You know, you would think it would stop at that point, but we kind of saw this as well with President Obama, where the Republican Congress said, we're just not going to work.
Right.
And that happened. That there's precedent to that, because the city council and council wars, as we know it, essentially said anything that you put forward, we have a block of 29 aldermen led by Fast Eddie Radoliak, right? Essentially said, we're not going to do anything,
right?
Because
and
we
they
don't
took
have
over
to.
The city council. They pretty much ran the city council, you know, for those 4 years until Washington won in 1987. He won re-election, beat him. And then I think a lot of the white aldermen, a lot of them just said, okay, this
when
is
you
enough.
When you were in City Hall as a reporter watching, I mean, because I only see the kangaroo court, the gaveling in,
right.
The terrace going up and
right.
Saying, we
you
should adjourn.
You only saw the controversial,
I only see the controversial
conflict. Well,
talk about the chaos there, this idea that city council, because, and also, Ray, I'm from Chicago, but I also came in, I think I moved here in 93. That's Mayor Richard M. Daley,
right.
And it's been rubber stamped for 25
right.
years.
It was like, you know, Daley was like, everybody looked at him as the antidote to racism. He was going to calm everything down, and that's how he sold himself. And I don't know, I'm not sure if things changed, but I get your point. Every day, honestly, in City Hall was pretty good. You don't write about all the good things. You know, Danny, when Washington was mayor, Danny Davis became the chairman of the Rules Committee. Now, the Rules Committee was where all the big secrets were. And one day, Danny Davis and I ran into him in the hallway, and I said, Danny, any chance I could look at those files? He goes, yeah, come on up. And I'm like going to have a heart attack because I've never heard an alderman say, yeah, come on. I'll open the files. You do whatever you want. And what I discovered really quick was that there was a process where if you wanted to do a development in a ward, you would give first. 6 weeks before the development came to the city council, you'd have to make a donation of $1,000 to $6,000 to the alderman.
Right.
And then it would come up for a vote, and if it was approved, then 6 weeks later you'd make another donation of $5,000 to $20,000 to the alderman. And we went, Danny Davis let us look at every file. We put a big story, because at that time I think it was 85, I got hired by the Sun-Times, so I was able to do that big story on that. So there were a lot of neat things that really did happen, and you would see Verdoliak and Washington fighting on TV, but on the side, they'd be joking. Because, you know, that's the difference, really, between Harold Washington and Barack Obama. Harold Washington was a political animal like the rest of them. I don't mean in a pejorative way. I mean, he was like, it was in his blood, politics. Barack Obama, I don't see him as being that machine-type alderman or anti-machine alderman. He was a very inspirational speaker, you know. And, of course, he had David Axelrod, who really helped him. He, you know, did a great job for him.
But what was the relationship like between the mayor, the mayor's staff, and the media, the
city
hall?
It was confrontational at first. People would come in, and his press office would constantly be saying, how could you write this? And I'd say, well, you know, he won't talk to me. If he's not going to talk to me, what am I supposed to do? I got to talk to whoever's there. I try to get what it is. They would say, well, you're just flacking for Verdoliak, or you're just flacking. I mean, we really took a beating for a while there. But after, I'd say, maybe about 8 months, it really kind of calmed down. And Harold had this great sense of humor. He was probably the funniest mayor Chicago ever had. He would look at an alderman who was a critic, and I think one of the ones that I remember was a guy named Alderman Jerry Orbach. And Orbach criticized Washington, and Washington said, you know, that Orbach, he has a smile like a bent tin can. Who comes up with lines like that? That takes genius to do that.
You know, there's something to be said about the relationship, because when I say the Washington camp, I think of all the surrogates. I think of Justice Pinchem. I think of even Dempsey Travis to an extent. I think of, you mentioned Danny Davis, Tim Evans, a lot of names that, like I said, that are still working in Chicago and Cook County today.
Yeah.
But what was the relationship like? Because it almost felt like reading Dempsey Travis's book, that they did the heavy lifting to accuse white aldermen of racism, to essentially call out what they thought to be unfair practice by the Chicago machine. It was almost the surrogates that did it more than Harold.
Listen, when Byrne was mayor, it was sexism. It said terrible things about Byrne, the B word. Vote for Rich, not the B. You know, and it rhymed with Rich. Then you get a black alderman, it becomes black and white. I mean, politicians will look for the differences that keep voters away from someone else, and they drive those home. That's what they do.
And we even see it today. I mean, we see it in the way that what's happening in Washington, where there seems to be a lot of tactics that are similar to that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, as a journalist, or I'm not a journalist anymore. I write columns for like the Reporter and the Regional and a couple other papers. So I just write my opinion. I just tell you what I think about facts. But there was a lot of anger and a feeling that, you know, people were being motivated by racism. I think racism was this like blanket over everything. But underneath, when you're sitting at City Hall, these guys were all friends. The black and white aldermen, they were all buddies. You know, Tim Evans and Sawyer. Sawyer eventually became mm-hmm. mayor. Mm-hmm. But these guys would talk to each other all the time. But, you know, out on the stage, they had to play their roles.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Ray Hanania, my guest, former City Hall reporter for the Southtown and the Sun-Times, covered Harold Washington. We're talking about Harold Washington because it's the 30th anniversary of his death, which will be this Saturday.
Now, he died on a Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
Talk about a slow news day, right?
Yeah, it was a vacation weekend, and I thought, oh, finally, I get some rest. You know, I'm at home, and I get this call, and they go, the mayor died. I go, come on, you're quit joking around. I told you, I just need this break. He goes, no, he died. Get down there. So you rush down there, and it was a madhouse. And I tell you what, my assignment was to interview all the bodyguards. All of the bodyguards were convinced that he was murdered. All of the bodyguards believed he had been poisoned.
Wow.
And then the rumors
were... That's a conspiracy theory that's kind of always bubbled on the surface, the surface.
When you think about it, it was here that they stopped him for 4 years. Then he won the election. He was in office only 7 months, starting to implement his vision for Chicago, and he dies? Come on, it can't just happen. So a lot of people in Chicago believed he was murdered. He was killed. Now, I don't know. He loved to eat. He was heavy. He was overweight. And, but... I don't know.
Yeah.
I still don't believe Oswald was the only guy who shot Kennedy. So,
all right, well, at least you put it in perspective, Ray. I'm interested in that chaos because, you know, ultimately, if we're going to talk about the death of Harold Washington, we have to talk about the days right after. I mean, to think about all the jockeying and the amazing, I mean, Dick Mell on a table and yelling and screaming. Talk about being in that experience with the idea of chaos or unpredictability happening in politics.
I had never been in a situation in City Hall, and I covered it about 18 years. First of all, that was the only time I ever saw Mike Royko actually come to City Hall. He came to City Hall. I got him to autograph some books. It was exciting to be with him. We didn't have cell phones and stuff like my kid, but, you know, back then, I wish we had him. But there were thousands of people that surrounded City Hall after Washington died. They wanted the black community, the real hardcore machine, black aldermen decided to go with the old Verdoliak 29 group. Mm. And that also fed into that rumor. Maybe he was killed because now these guys are coming back to take control through
like
another
Julius Caesar type stuff going on here.
Yeah, no, it was. And Gene Sawyer, the guy, I don't ever recall writing a story with his name in it. And all of a sudden, he becomes the candidate that these aldermen want to elect as the acting mayor. Tim Evans was right at Washington's side the whole time, and they stopped him. So for 11 hours, City Hall was surrounded by thousands of people.
Which is interesting, Ray, is that you talked about the forces to try and stop Harold Washington for 7 years.
Right.
Four and a half years were the same ultimately in 11 hours that stopped his successor.
They did. And They put Sawyer in knowing that Sawyer could not keep office. You know, I look back at it, you know, and in a way I feel bad because it almost sounds racist in the context of the racist atmosphere that existed. We referred to him as Mayor Mumbles because Mayor Mumbles, we couldn't understand him. The guy never quoted him. Do you know what I mean? He was elected to represent a ward. He was the nicest guy in the world. He represented a ward that nobody cared about, nobody paid any attention to. Suddenly he becomes the mayor, and he's forced to get up there and
make
talk.
Speeches and he's rally the troops,
speaker.
And he's not a good speaker.
He just doesn't know how to talk. He wasn't elected to be a speaker. He was elected
and
to
ultimately
run a
you
ward.
Wonder if that was part of the strategy.
Oh, no, it was. They put him in because they knew that eventually they would get him out. And he lost the election, and Daley got elected.
You think about some of the players in that, and I always think about this when I see city council today. And some are there's still traces and remnants of what the block, the 29, the Verdelia.
Ed Burke is still around.
I want to throw a couple name associations.
Ed
Burke. You see Ed Burke with the glasses and the brown hair, and
now you
see him.
Ed is a good guy. He's brilliant. The guy is smart. And, you know, when you really look at the way politics played out, he was always there. As a force in forging whatever happened. Jane Byrne was pushed out because Verdelia and Burke hated her. They couldn't stand her after Richard J. Daley died. They didn't like her, so they kicked her out. She then went after them and said it was the evil cabal of men, which included them and Fred Rohde, which is why she ran. Burke was there, and he managed to surface in every administration.
It's amazing, too, because he stands up. I mean, it's Verdoliak and Burke.
I think he's a decent guy. Verdoliak, probably one of the smartest aldermen, you know, I had ever covered. Because, you know, when you're an alderman, you only need to know two things. You only need to count up to the number of your ward. So, and two, you need to know that Fred Rohde, the first ward alderman, whatever his vote was, that's the vote the way you voted. You didn't have to know what the issue was. So once they said 14th Ward, you'd get up there and, you know, of course that was Ed Burke. You'd say, aye. That's the way Rohde voted. That's it. What way did Alderman would literally during meetings say, how did Rohde vote?
I mean, I think of Burton Terrace was it there. It's funny to see him come in there. I mean, these aldermen have had so many different
Bernie
lives.
Stone was
Bernie
there for
Stone.
A long time.
I think of, as you mentioned, Tim Evans. There's so many people that that continue to work in Chicago politics.
Yeah, Tim Evans is over as a chief justice now. Good guy.
So the lasting impact of this, I mean, the death of Harold Washington, did it end a certain style of politics in Chicago and make way for the status and the norm to come back? Or
I think it took voters and the people of Chicago, and not just Chicago, but Chicago went up to this brink to say, this is the hell that we're going to be in if it gets worse. And I think that made people kind of calm down because I think things are a little bit calmer, at least in Chicago. Our problems are not really politics, are they? I think it's, you know, street gangs. You know, we still have political battles and things, but I don't think it's politics that drives the news in Chicago anymore. Politics, there was a time when it really was the big sport in Chicago. I'm not sure it's that way anymore.
Ray, I think, you know, we were just kind of talking about how the history books are going to look at this and you know, just younger kids today don't even learn about Harold Washington and his impact. Yeah.
If I mentioned my son Aaron is with me and we were talking on the way over. He goes, he's asking me like, who did you cover? And I'm naming all these mayors and he's looking at me like I'm, you know, speaking a foreign language. But as soon as I said Harold Washington, he goes, oh, yeah, that's the library. And then I go, oh, and Jane Byrne. And he goes, yeah, that's the intersection. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe we should give every mayor some icon. But I don't think they teach enough about who these people were because Jane Byrne was the first woman mayor. And for whatever the politics, she was a pretty decent person. She did some great things. Harold Washington, first black mayor of Chicago, whatever the politics, the guy had a great sense of humor. He was very smart. He did a lot of good things in Chicago. But we don't remember those guys.
Ray Hanania was a City Hall reporter at the Daily Southdown and Chicago Sun-Times, covered Harold Washington. He was worked from 76 to 92. He's a reporter, and he's also an author of several books, including I'm Glad I Look Like a Terrorist Growing Up Arab in America. And he's also a spokesperson for Cicero. It's funny, you're in the paper constantly.
I got 1 foot in column writing and 1 foot in media relations. Believe me, after a while of killing yourself being a reporter— barely making enough money to survive. You want to just kind of pay all your bills, and that's how you do it in media relations.
Well, we got to have you back. Much more to talk about. Ray, great to have you here.
Thanks, Justin.
Thanks for the memories.